Wake up, Coastal Carolina. Wake up. This is your CCTA Wake Up Call.
Produced by the Coastal Carolina Taxpayers Association, a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization dedicated to the preservation of the U.S. Constitution, free enterprise, and individual liberty.
Good morning, Coastal Carolina, and welcome to CCTA Wake Up Call. I'm your host, Rick Hopkins. Well, this morning we're going to be talking with a constitutional attorney. She's also a teacher. Scientist. She works for the 10th Amendment Center. Her name is Diane Ruffino, and she's from the Greenville area. And I asked Diane to come and be the guest speaker at next Tuesday night's public meeting, and she has agreed to do that. So let's get a little preview of what we can expect to hear from Diane Ruffino next Tuesday night at CCTA's monthly public meeting. Okay, I'm on the line with Diane Ruffino. Diane's from Greenville area, and she's also a scientist, teacher, attorney, and a writer. And she's done quite a bit over the years writing about our constitutional rights and freedoms. And so I've invited Diane to be the guest speaker at next Tuesday's public meeting. That would be August the 16th. And that'll be downtown New Bern at Stanley Hall Ballroom at 7 p.m. And Diane, the reason I wanted you to come and talk to us about our constitutional rights is because they seem to be getting trampled on all the time. Specifically, House Bill 2 is an issue here in North Carolina, and the overturn of the voter ID. Well, I say overturn. It's still in the court system and going up before the Supreme Court, I guess. So are you up to date on those, and have you got an opinion on what's going on?
Well, I heard a little bit about the decision today. I started reading the decision from the Fourth Circuit, and it troubled me. So I can talk about the voter ID. I can talk a little bit about HB2 as well. So wherever you want to start.
Well, let's talk about the voter ID first. You know, that it seems like we're never going to get to an election cycle here without some kind of shenanigans going on by the liberals out there that just are always complaining about something. Even though in the primary, voting was up, it didn't seem to be hurt any at all by the voter ID. But can you tell us what these three judges are basing their opinion on, because it obviously is not the Constitution, even though they say it is?
Well, that's right. So there's no absolute right or protectable right in the Constitution. So usually when they have a right that's protected in the Constitution, that's considered your fundamental right, and then the judges can look at that and apply equal protection and all that kind of stuff under strict scrutiny. In this case, the judges are saying, from what I can read from the decision, it's a very troubling decision, I should say that. They're saying that the legislature had racial intent when they passed this voter ID law. And they said that despite their language, that really it was to kind of diminish the African-American vote. Now, as soon as you start the decision, it says that the North, and I believe there is some kind of bias by these justices or these court judges. So it starts off by saying that the party now in control of the state legislature, in parentheses, which does not enjoy the support of African Americans. So they're setting it up, right? They're setting up this is intentional, but they don't say the Republican Party, but they're saying this. Then they said that the legislature noticed that African Americans came out in force, so the African American voting percentage increased from say 2008 to 2012, which we know what those administrations are, right? That's Obama. Now, the justices never mentioned that the reason African-American voting came up, right, that increase is because they're voting for an African-American man for president. So you can imagine that's an incentive for them to come out and vote. And there was the community organizing that went into effect to get them out to vote. So they're saying that the legislature, because they are Republican, because they noticed that the last two elections, the African-Americans came out and they increased their voting presence, well, now that's a problem because they don't enjoy the support of the African-Americans. So let's do whatever we can to prevent them from coming out and voting in force. You know, they noticed that whites didn't increase their voting as much. So this law should, in their minds, I guess, kind of discriminate against African-Americans. It'll prevent them from coming out in force.
Right.
So I think they're imputing an animus or improper intent on our legislature where it doesn't exist.
Right.
Because common sense tells you that when you have a fraud problem, as we do in North Carolina, and the Voter Integrity Project can bear that out, and when you do see that instances of voter fraud, there we have this push from citizens who say that we need some kind of integrity in our voting system to ensure the constitutional protection, one person, one vote. If a person is voting twice, well, that diminishes my vote, right? I'm no longer one vote, I'm maybe a half a vote or no vote. Maybe it's canceling my vote, maybe it's canceling your vote. And that's what the integrity is all about, is to make sure that every person has a vote, counts one, not half, not zero. And the common sense voter ID, to produce an ID to say who you are, that I do live here, I am a, you know, I am a citizen of the state, and, you know, I'm not voting in three states. So it's a common sense way that it's colorblind. Everybody knows they need an ID. In 2016, it's incumbent on everybody to get some kind of an ID for all these things that you need to do in life. So on its face, it sounds like it's neutral, it's colorblind, but they are imputing that this is hurting African Americans. They can't get voter ID. And not only that, but it was intentional that this law went into place for the voter ID.
Right. And then NAACP filed this suit against the state,
right,
on those grounds, making those claims. But where's the evidence to back that up? Because in the primary, everybody had to show a voter ID. And I haven't heard of one lawsuit because somebody was denied their right to vote.
Exactly. There really is no evidence. And if you go look back to the 2008, it's a case, and I don't know if it's Iowa, Indiana, but they had a voter ID law that went to the Supreme Court. The same exact thing. It's almost identical to ours, and it requires a photo ID. And not only does it require a photo ID, but it has a provision, as ours does, that if you do not have one, you cannot get one, the state will provide it for you. So this was filed by, I believe the NAACP as well, but, you know, African American community. They filed it, and it went to the Supreme Court, and the most liberal justice was the one that did the questioning, most of the questioning, and he wrote the opinion. He said, there was absolutely no evidence. When they pursed through all the evidence, there was no credible evidence that these people could not get that ID by the state. If they couldn't get it on their own, there was no evidence that they couldn't have been provided one.
Matter of fact, our state has gone out of its way to make every accommodation for being able to get a photo ID as easy as possible and free.
Mm-hmm. Now, I remember when the voter ID was going through, you know, this was back in like 2012 maybe, we kept pushing for the voter ID law, and they said it was forthcoming, and we never saw it. And they kept saying, well, it's with our lawyers, and we want to make sure it's right so it's not challenged. Remember they kept saying that?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
They want to make sure the language was right, it comported with everything the Supreme Court required. and they just wanted it reviewed and reviewed so that it wasn't able to be challenged. And so they did everything right. So I think that's the intent there, to show that they weren't trying to discriminate. They were trying to do everything right, weighing the state interest. The state interests are, you know, integrity in our voting system and the rights of citizens. So they're balancing this out every way they can. They took their time, almost, well over a year, maybe 2 years. So I don't think the courts took that part into consideration. So I think Governor McCrory has appealed to the Supreme Court for a rush judgment, and they want this decision. They want to be able to use this law for November.
Right, and there's other precedents out there, because there's 23, I believe, other states that are 26 that already have voter ID laws.
Right,
so
right.
It's not something that's not already out there.
Yeah.
Well, Diane, I'm going to stop here to take a quick break to hear from our sponsors.
Sure.
When we come back, I'd like to talk about House Bill 2.
Sure.
Okay, we are back with Diane Ruffino, constitutional attorney, teacher, scientist, writer. Quite a resume she has, and she's an excellent speaker on those subjects. And Diane is going to be with us next Tuesday night. That's August the 16th at our public meeting downtown in New Bern at Stanley Hall Ballroom. And Diane, House Bill 2. Just like we were talking about the voter ID, it's trying to be made out to be something it's not. My understanding is when the legislature came out with House Bill 2, it was because Charlotte stepped out of the bounds in its authority to be able to do what it did. They did not have the authority to try to tell businesses what to do with as far as bathrooms. And,
right.
So that's what the legislature did, was simply try to put together some legislation to reinforce the fact that only the legislature can give a municipality, a city, the authority to pass a law like that. So it had nothing to do with LGBT agenda or anti-LGBT agenda. It had to do with upholding the Constitution of our state and the laws that were already on the books. Am I right there?
Yeah, I believe you're right. Yep. They didn't want one set of rule in Charlotte and everything different in the other parts of the state. They wanted consistent policy.
Right. And so Charlotte, by the fact that they went ahead and passed locally there in Charlotte, the law, they were not authorized to do that by our Constitution. Only the legislature could give them that authority.
Right. And they did it, I believe, in a back kind of way. They didn't do things on the up and up there. It was pushed by a registered sex offender, I believe. I don't remember the man's name. Maybe something Hill, right? It was questionable how that was passed.
Well, the left's definitely got a history of pushing agendas out there and using biases as far as sexual bias and racial bias as the motive. And oftentimes, neither of those exist or are not the intent of what our legislators are doing.
Right. Yep. And once it's made into a civil rights type of issue, all the other equally important issues seem to fall by the wayside or are obscured by smoke and mirrors and all that kind of stuff.
And, of course, the media is very complicit in that, because they love to jump on that bandwagon.
That's true.
Again, let's look at the marriage amendment. You know, that was another case where we, the voters, passed that overwhelmingly, and then we had these liberal judges come in and overturn it. What can we do to stop this from happening over and over again? You know, there's got to be a solution to it.
Well, in my mind, I work with the 10th Amendment Center. So the remedy I believe that the states hold in their power, but rarely states want to assert this, but there's a doctrine called nullification. Nullification and interposition. So nullification means that when a branch of government, so the government has powers specifically given to it under the U.S. Constitution, and that applies to any of the three branches. When it exceeds its grant of power, then any law enacted pursuant to that excess of power, that usurpation or abuse of power, is not a law at all. It's a void, it's null and void, and it is not enforceable. Legally, it's not enforceable. So that's the nullification thing, is the government has only a certain amount of power to make laws for us. When it goes beyond those powers, then it doesn't have the power to do that. So by right, by theory, legal theory, is that such a law is not enforceable. But who's going to stand up to the government and say that law is not enforceable? Well, the government's never going to admit that it took power that it shouldn't, right? And that's the history of the United States. The history of the government is these little creeping, it creeps forward by taking little bits of power until finally we wake up and we don't have a 10th Amendment anymore. So the rightful remedy, as dictated, articulated, by Thomas Jefferson and James Madison, is that when a government does that, when an actor, when the federal court system, when they say, when they come up with something that is clearly unconstitutional, taking away rights and powers from the people or the state, the Ninth and Tenth Amendments, then it is up to the state to say, no, you just stepped on our powers. And because you did, your law is null and void. We're not going to recognize it in our state. That's nullification. And nullification can take any form it wants. It could be a nullification bill. It can be a resolution. It can be these bills that say any federal officer that tries to indict any of our or prosecute any of our citizens for this unconstitutional law, we will imprison that federal officer. Or something like that. And that's what the state should be doing. So if the court says your marriage amendment is null and void, is unconstitutional, the state will say, well, you're kind of assuming powers that were not granted. You're making up new law. You're inventing, you're stepping into state police power rights. The state historically has the right to define marriage. That's unquestioned. It has the right to regulate abortion laws. It has the right to regulate voting. In fact, it has the right to regulate voting laws. So when the government or the federal, a branch of the federal government, the federal courts say, no, your marriage amendment is unconstitutional and you can't enforce it, the state says, wait a minute, you just stepped on our territory. Marriage is something historically we regulate under the 14th Amendment, and I could go into that too. But because the government, because the federal courts have stepped into my territory, what your decision is fine and good, but we don't have to abide by it.
All right, we're talking about state sovereignty, right?
Yeah, right. So you're stepping in, you're invading,
state.
right, and states have to start sticking up for their sovereignty, or somewhere down the road. We don't have it anymore because we just let it go for so long, and the government. Well, hey, we've been deciding on this issue. We've taken it over. You guys have failed to do it, so someone's got to do it.
Well, Diane, why won't they do it? We've got an attorney general. The attorney general is not fighting for us. Is not doing his job. And when I ask legislators, what do we do about that? Can we impeach him? What can we do? Because he's not doing the job. He's not fighting this marriage amendment issue. He's not fighting the House Bill 2 issue. He's not fighting the voting rights issue. He's on the other side of the fence there. Why?
He's a liberal. He's a liberal. He's a progressive.
But why isn't our governor in the legislature not doing anything?
So I believe it's Article 5, Section 5, Article 5, something like that. It lists out impeachment, when officials of the government are not doing their job, and that's dereliction of duty is one of those terms, dereliction of duty. Then the House, the state House, brings charges of impeachment, just like they would do in the U.S. House, and citing a dereliction of duty. It's right there, black and white, and that's exactly what he's doing. He's not doing his job. He's collecting a paycheck. Then they bring the charges. They pass it in the House. It goes to the Senate, and the Senate impeaches them, you know, removes them or does the actual impeachment, removing them from office. Now, we just have to get our House to, you know, get a backbone and do their job and make sure that they spend a lot of time passing these bills. They're doing the will of the people. They have to go home to their constituents and say, listen, you know, I'm doing what you ask me to do, but, you know, I don't want to have a fight. You know, I'll enact the law, but I really won't fight for it. They've got to do that. And part of fighting for the law is making sure our attorney general enforces it.
Right.
They're only doing half the battle.
Well, maybe so, we're not doing our job in trying to get them to move in that direction. Maybe they need to hear more from us.
Maybe we need a rally on that Halifax Square. Maybe we need everybody show up with impeach Roy Cooper signs. And it'll get some press attention, and maybe the House will move forward. But again, these things are in the Constitution, in our state Constitution. We don't take these things seriously. We all want to be protected by the Constitution. Oh, it protects our rights. It does this. It does that. But we got to read it, and we got to make sure our legislators read it, and we've got to use it. It's not a blank piece of paper. We can't render it useless, as Thomas Jefferson said. You can't render it useless by really not knowing what it means.
Well,
so
I think we're running out of time and options, and we better get busy doing something. And what makes it even more perplexing as to why they won't do something is they have a supermajority.
That's right.
You know, why haven't they done more things? Well, Diane, I appreciate you taking time to talk to us tonight. Looking forward to next Tuesday. You can go ahead and be looking into this further and bring us some more information on the subject. Nullification especially. I'm sure the audience would like to hear more about that. And,
my favorite subject.
Yeah. And what we, the people, as a people, what can we do to get these legislators' attention and get the ball rolling? So really look forward to seeing you next Tuesday night, 7 o'clock, Stanley Hall Ballroom, downtown New Bern.
Thank you, Rick. I'm looking forward to it.
All right. Let's take a quick break here to hear from our sponsors, and we'll be right back to close out today's show. Welcome back to CCTA Wake Up Call. Well, I hope you enjoyed our conversation with Diane Rufino. And I'd like to invite you to please come out Tuesday night. That's August the 16th at 7 p.m. at Stanley Hall Ballroom. And Diane will be our guest speaker that night. She'll be bringing us more information. After her presentation, of course, as always with our public meetings, there'll be Q&A. Session, so you'll be able to ask Diane questions, and of course you'll be able to mingle with members of CCTA and get to meet us and know us and talk to us about how you might be interested in getting involved to help us spread the word and educate people on what's going on politically in our area. So that's Tuesday night at 7 o'clock downtown Stanley Hall Ballroom. That's all we have for today. We'll see you again next week.